Our scripture lesson tonight comes from Proverbs chapter 27. Proverbs chapter 27. Hear now the word of our God. Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring. Let another praise you, and not your own mouth, a stranger, and not your own lips. A stone is heavy, and sand is weighty, but a fool's provocation is heavier than both. Wrath is cruel, anger is overwhelming, but who can stand before jealousy? Better is open rebuke than hidden love. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy. One who is full loathes honey, but to one who is hungry, everything bitter is sweet. Like a bird that strays from its nest is a man who strays from his home. Oil and perfume make the heart glad, and the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel. Do not forsake your friend and your father's friend, and do not go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother who is far away. Be wise, my son, and make my heart glad, that I may answer him who reproaches me. The prudent see danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. Take a man's garment when he has put up security for a stranger, and hold it in pledge when he puts up security for an adulteress. Whoever blesses his neighbor with a loud voice, rising early in the morning, will be counted as cursing. A continual dripping on a rainy day and a quarrelsome wife are alike. To restrain her is to restrain the wind, or to grasp oil in one's right hand. Iron sharpens iron, and one man sharpens another. Whoever tends a fig tree will eat its fruit, and he who guards his master will be honored. As in water face reflects face, so the heart of man reflects the man. Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied, and never satisfied are the eyes of man. The crucible is for silver, and the furnace for gold, and a man is tested by his praise. Crush a fool in a mortar with a pestle, along with crushed grain. Yet his folly will not depart from him. Know well the condition of your flocks, and give attention to your herds, for riches do not last forever. And does a crown endure to all generations? When the grass is gone and the new growth appears, and the vegetation of the mountains is gathered, the lambs will provide your clothing, and the goats the price of a field. For the food of your household, there will be enough goat's milk for your food and for the food of your household, the maintenance for your girls. This is the word of the Lord. Proverbs 27 is the central chapter in this section of five chapters, chapters 25 to 29, which are the Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah copied. And in this central section, we hear about what it means to be a friend, yes, but notice what friendship is entailing here. There are two parallel sections, verses 1 through 10 and verses 11 to 22, each of which starts with an opening proverb about reputation, followed by a brief discussion of impossible relationships and true friendship, each of which concludes with a triplet in the final verse signifying sort of, usually you find them in doublets or quatrains, but you have these triplets which changes the poetic structure and signals that you're at a transition point. And all of this is then followed by a brief section on shepherding in verses 23 to 27, which at first might seem out of place until you remember that these are the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, copied by the men of Hezekiah. The kings of the house of David were shepherd kings. The king is a shepherd, and for that matter, so are all those in authority. And in fact, that last section has that reference to a crown does not last for all generations, which, if you're just talking to shepherds, why are you talking about crowns? What does a king have to do with friendship? Well, a friend is more than just a buddy. A friend is one who has your back. And as our Lord put it, greater love has no man than this, that he lays down his life for his friend. Friendship has to do with being there for each other and those worst moments. Now, Proverbs 27 doesn't go all the way to where Jesus takes it, but Proverbs 27 sets course in that direction. Jesus is the King, who is a friend closer than a brother. Now, we start with the question, what sort of friend should you be? There's a way in which this passage moves, it sort of raises the question of what is a good friend, and then challenges you to be that sort of friend. For starters, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring. Let another praise you, and not your own mouth, a stranger, and not your own lips. Don't praise yourself. The Hebrew word translated boast is the same as the Hebrew word translated praise in these verses. The problem is that in English, we use two different words for this. We might say, do not praise yourself about tomorrow, but we don't usually talk that way. We use the word boast. So boast is a perfectly good translation. Just recognize that it's the same Hebrew word behind both boast and praise. The point is simple. Don't talk yourself up. Let others do that. Now, there's an unspoken implication here, but maybe if you've learned wisdom from the last 26 chapters, you've already thought of this. If you're not supposed to praise others, if you're not supposed to boast, what should you do? You should praise others, not praising yourself. If you should let others praise you, then they will depend upon you for their praise. It's not a matter of strict reciprocity. It's not a racket where, I'll praise you if you'll praise me, ha ha. No, your praise needs to be genuine. But genuine does not mean just spontaneous, whenever you feel like it. Anyone who knew me 20 years ago would undoubtedly testify that I was not very good at praising others. I'm still not very good at it, but it's something I've worked at. And there were two things that motivated me in this. First, I realized that by my being stingy with praise, I was harming others. When they did something good, they deserved my praise. I was withholding from them what I owed them. In that sense, I was a praise thief. I was not praising them. I was not telling them, good job, well done, thank you. And then I also realized that my stinginess proceeded from my own longing for praise. Well, if you're not going to praise me, then I'm not going to praise you. I had to give up and say, that's not my job. Deny myself, take up my cross, follow Jesus. I had to learn to praise others, not make things up, not to sort of say something nice about them even though they really did. You know, no, sincerely and genuinely praise them for the good things they did. The Lord detests the proud but exalts the humble. Self-praise, when you exalt yourself, that diminishes your status and suggests that you are proud. It also suggests maybe you feel undervalued, you are socially insecure. Sort of the one who boasts a lot, the one who brags, the one who keeps inflating himself is doing that because he's not actually secure in himself or in the Lord his God. And if you think about it, part of what this is saying is the proud cannot be a true friend. A true friend is humble and praises others and doesn't feel the need to spout off their own deeds. And when you think about it like that, the next two verses about impossible relationships fit really well here. A stone is heavy and sand is weighty, but a fool's provocation is heavier than both. We've often seen the idea of glory or honor as a matter of weightiness. And yes, it's the same root here, kabad, but it's in a form that is never used to mean glory, because not all weightiness is honoring and glorifying. There's also a weightiness, a heaviness that just sinks you down. It's a heaviness that is oppressive and destructive. I mean, a stone is heavy. And if anything, sand is heavier. Just try lifting a beach. These are heavy loads that put a strain on the body. But that strain is nothing compared to the emotional burden of a fool's provocation. The fool's provocation is heavier than both. The emotional weight you carry when you're dealing with the shenanigans of a fool is far greater than any physical burden. And undoubtedly you've experienced this when you've been dealing with somebody at work or somebody at home or somebody in sort of in some relationship who's acting in a vexatious, foolish way. It results in a weightiness, being sunk down, because your whole being is consumed by this problem. But it can get worse. Wrath is cruel. Anger is overwhelming. But who can stand before jealousy? Verse 4. Wrath and anger are unbearable. But jealousy? Jealousy turns into a cold rage that sweeps everything away. You did what to whom? You're going to die. What is it that leads to, you know, half of the movies that are made out there? Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. It's jealousy, revenge, that just, you did what to me? You killed my father. Jealousy is an irresistible force that will not stop until it has accomplished its purpose. Now, these impossible relationships, the vexatious fool, the jealous man, set us up for the picture of the true friend. Because we all need friends. We need people in our lives who will speak and act like this. Verse 5. Better is open rebuke than hidden love. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy. We need people who can speak straight to us, who can openly rebuke us and wound us with faithful words. Now, verses 5 and 6 point out that appearances can be deceitful. Usually you think of wounds as bad and kisses as good. But the wounds of a friend are designed for our good, just as the kiss of Judas was the signal for the betrayal of our Lord. I was once having coffee with a friend. He noticed my eyes were straying. He kicked me under the table. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Now, I'd also point out that these proverbs are cumulative. In other words, you can't just pick and choose the ones you want to follow and then ignore the ones you don't. If you are never praising others, verses 1 and 2, then kicking them, verses 5 and 6, will only be taken as mean and spiteful. In other words, you have to demonstrate friendship in order for them to hear those words that are of rebuke that they need to hear. You have to be a friend. You have to have their back, be there for them, before they will hear your open rebuke well. On the other hand, beware of hidden love, because hidden love isn't love. Hidden love means that you don't actually love the other person enough to rebuke them. You'd rather just sit back and watch them destroy themselves. Go ahead, have fun. I like how Bruce Waltke puts it. Secret love is like winking at a girl in the dark. It does neither her nor you any good. Open, loving rebuke is potent. Hidden love is impotent. Moses had said this in the law, in Leviticus 19, verses 17 and 18. Verse 17 says, rebuke your neighbor frankly. And it's followed by verse 18, love your neighbor as yourself. Loving your neighbor will mean rebuking him openly. It will also mean being engaged with him enough that he will hear your rebuke. And then in the middle of this discussion of friendship comes a reflection on marriage in verses 7 and 8. Verse 7 could be translated, a satisfied soul tramples down a honeycomb. One who is full, one whose appetite is sated, has no use for honey. But to one who is hungry, everything bitter is sweet. I've titled this section, The Frailty of Contentment, because I've seen how this goes wrong in all sorts of ways. Some would say to wives, make sure your husband is satisfied, otherwise he might stray. But that puts all the blame and all the requirements on the wife. Others would say to husbands, you just need to be content regardless of what your wife does. This advice, as much as the first, has lost the sight of the heart of wisdom. Now, the solution is found in verse 8, although verse 8 is complicated by a very interesting translation question. The word translated stray in verse 8, the man who strays from his home, is actually everywhere else in the Old Testament is translated flee. Every other usage in the Old Testament is in the context of being forced to flee. It's never used of a sort of voluntary straying. Isaiah 16, verse 2, the prophet says, like fleeing birds, like a scattered nest, so are the daughters of Moab. Likewise in Jeremiah 4:25, I looked and behold, there was no man, and all the birds of the air had fled. Now, if you're used to thinking of the ancient world as a strictly patriarchal place in which men did what they wanted and women just had to put up with it, this portrayal of the ancient home may come as a bit of a shock. In fact, it shocks translators enough to make them translate a verb opposite of its normal meaning because they couldn't imagine that it meant what it actually said. They couldn't imagine a man fleeing from his home. But that's what it says. The man is being chased from his home. Now, who or what is chasing him? Now, notice our text doesn't really say. There's not a single answer to this question unless you would say folly is chasing him. But it might be his own folly. Think back to verse 1. Do not boast about tomorrow. Is this a proud man who has created his own dilemma? It might be the provocation of another fool, verse 3. Or the bitterness of jealousy, verse 4. It might be the silence of hidden love, verse 5. Or the kisses of an enemy, verse 6. It might be the hunger of an unsatisfied soul, verse 7. But is that because of himself, because he's been playing with folly? Or is it because of his wife, because she's the one playing with folly? Our text doesn't give one answer because there are lots of different situations in which this is true. However it came to pass, folly is chasing him from his home. It might be domestic trouble. It might be famine, war, exile, bad judgment. But for whatever reason, he's fleeing. Like a bird that flees from its nest is a man who flees from his home. Where does he go in the day of calamity? Well, he goes to a friend. Indeed, he goes to a sweet friend. Verse 9, oil and perfume make the heart glad. There are few things in all the world more powerful than good smells. Good smells can take you back to the best moments in your life. But there's one thing better than the best smells. The sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel. What makes a friend sweet? His earnest counsel. Actually, I love this phrase. Earnest counsel is a fabulous translation. But the Hebrew word is the word soul. But if you just say his soulish counsel, it's really not going to communicate much to an American English-speaking audience. So earnest counsel, great, great, great way to say it. But the idea is this is counsel from his soul. The word soul was used twice in verse 7, the full soul and the hungry soul. The soul, the nefesh, is used in Scripture to refer to the self. It has the idea of any creature that breathes is a nefesh, a living soul, nefesh hayah. So what makes a friend so sweet is his counsel from the soul. When he speaks, he tells you what he thinks. You know that you're getting exactly what he thinks will be good for you. Now, if you have a friend like that, then, for me, it's David Covington. David and Sharon Covington. These are people who you walk anywhere near them and there's like the warm, sweet smell just like, ooh, it's like everywhere. It's like, I'm home. That's David. From seminary days, he has spoken wisely and well to me, and they did our premarital counseling when Ginger and I were getting married. But that sweetness of that earnest counsel, that counsel from the soul, that you know you're getting everything this person can possibly think of that will be good for you. If you have a friend like that, do not forsake your friend and your father's friend. That's not two different people. This is your friend, namely your father's friend. The idea here is that your father's friend will be your friend as well. If you love your friend, obviously, you will love his children because they remind you of him. It's for the same reason when you love God, you love those who are made in this image. When you love a person, you love those that are connected to them. Your father's friend is someone who has shown loyalty and faithfulness for a long time. When things go badly, he will be there for you. And do not go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. What? Why not go to your brother's house? What's wrong with your brother? Well, the last line explains. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother who is far away. The point here is don't go a long way. You need somebody close. I mean, you think about, okay, sure, there's cultural differences between the ancient Near East and the modern world. I love it, however, that this text bridges all of those gaps and says, even though, okay, our situation may be nothing like theirs, yet it hits exactly home for us, too. After all, I know, there are a couple of you who actually do have family members in South Bend. There's a couple of you. But for most of you, your family is scattered all over the country, all over the world in some cases. And the point in our society is, as we get scattered like this, we need the Church of Jesus Christ to be that family that holds us and is there for us in the day of calamity. The picture here is that greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. And our second section in verses 11 to 22 follows the same pattern as the first, starting once again with reputation. Here, in verse 11, be wise, my son, and make my heart glad that I may answer him who reproaches me. Father and son are bound together against a common adversary, this one who reproaches me. And the son's wise behavior will provide an answer to the reproach. And you can see how Jesus plays off this in John's gospel. The son is the father's answer to all sorts of questions. But what does it mean to be wise? Verse 12, well, the prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. Be prudent. Be shrewd. Don't be gullible. The simple, after all, in Proverbs, is not a neutral category. The simple will continue on their simple ways until they are destroyed. The simple, according to Proverbs, are simply fools just waiting to happen. Why do I say that? Because the simple are ignoring the call of wisdom. The simple are insisting on staying simple. How long will you remain simple? If you remain simple, you'll become a fool. The prudent sees danger and hides himself. Always. I don't know any exceptions to this. The prudent sees danger and hides himself. You might say, but Jesus, he went to the cross. But Jesus did not. Jesus was following this command. The prudent sees danger and hides himself. After he was born, Herod tried to kill him. Joseph and Mary saw danger, they hid themselves. The crowd tried to seize him, Jesus hid himself. When they tried to make him king, Jesus hid himself. When Satan offered him a way to glory that would bypass the cross, Jesus recognized a danger greater than death. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus saw danger. Oh, yeah, there was that guy named Judas and that whole kiss thing. That wasn't the greatest danger in Gethsemane. The greatest danger in Gethsemane was that Jesus would abandon his father's will. But Jesus was a wise and prudent son. He was, after all, the only begotten son of God, who was with the Father in the beginning. There was nothing in Jesus that was inclined toward folly. He saw the danger. He recognized it as the temptation that it was. But he hid himself from that danger the only place he could, on the cross. The cross was the only place for Jesus to hide from the danger of abandoning the cross, because abandoning the way of the cross was the ultimate folly. So he walked the path of the cross because he knew that that was the only path where he could avoid danger. You see, that's where when you and I are called to take up our cross, it's because that's the way to Jesus. And in those moments when you are called to deny yourself, take up your cross and follow him, it is clear that I will either abandon Jesus and walk away, or I will endure suffering for Jesus' sake. Well, the greatest danger I can imagine is turning away from Jesus. Therefore, I will follow the cross. I will take up my cross and follow Jesus because that is the way of safety. Oh, to the world that looks like danger. You're crazy. You're going to die. But to the Christian, it's the only safe place to be. We see another set of impossible relationships then in verses 13 and 16. First, take a man's garment when he has put up security for a stranger and hold it in pledge when he puts up security for an adulteress. We've seen this theme of putting up security repeatedly in Proverbs. And you think about the picture here. You're being asked to lend money to a stranger, perhaps even to an adulteress. Now, note that the father here has no objections to making such a loan. The father recognizes that everyone needs help when they're in trouble. You don't deny a person a loan simply because they're a stranger. You don't even deny a person a loan if they're engaging in sinful actions. You just need to be careful in the terms of your loan. The stranger is unknown to you. The adulteress is known and known to engage in wrong behavior. So make sure that you have good collateral, because these people are likely to skip out on you. The terms of your loan can be really generous when it's somebody who's known to you, but not so much when they are likely to skip out. The second example is one with a bad sense of timing, you might say. Whoever blesses his neighbor with a loud voice, verse 14, rising early in the morning will be counted as cursing. I mean, just think about the picture here. You know, if somebody's outside your window at 6 o'clock in the morning saying, "Good morning, neighbor, have a wonderful day," you probably aren't going to be all that happy. A hypocritical benediction is a malediction. And the wise man will see this. And of course, God sees right through it. And as we saw last time, the undeserved curse never lands. It has no effect. There's a way in which the Apostle John builds off of this in 1 John 3 when he says, "Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth." It's not just how you talk. Real friendship is expressed in deed and in truth, not just pious pronouncements, not just warm, fuzzy statements. But then our final impossible relation is the quarrelsome wife. Verses 15 and 16. A continual dripping on a rainy day and a quarrelsome wife are alike. To restrain her is to restrain the wind, or to grasp oil in one's right hand. And it's worth noting that it goes both ways. If Proverbs was written by a mother to her daughter, she might speak of the quarrelsome husband. But this is speaking of a father to his son. So that's why the gender goes this way here. But we also have a translation issue, because the word translated restrain, again, it doesn't ever mean restrain. It means to hide or lay up. Again, there may be the translators may be having certain assumptions that are leading them into this translation. Waltke, however, suggests translating it shelter. So think about the image here. To shelter her is to shelter the wind on a rainy day. A continual dripping on a rainy day and a quarrelsome wife are alike. To shelter her, the man takes shelter under the roof of his home, expecting to find protection from the storm. Instead, he finds his leaky roof provides him no shelter from the torrential downpour. In the same way, he married with the expectation of finding good, but the wife from whom he expected protection from the rudeness of the world harshly attacks him at home. Marriage is supposed to be a place where husband and wife find shelter together, But if you find the storm inside your shelter, that's not the way things are supposed to be. And so we ask again, what is friendship? Because what is it that we are to be doing in our relationships?